Three messages before we get started. First, do you need a single phone number that comes with multiple extensions so anyone who works at your company can be reached no matter where they are? Go to grasshopper.com. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. Next, does anyone you know need a beautiful online store that actually increases sales but is easy to set up and manage? Send them to shopify.com. The platform that top online stores are running on right now. Finally, do you need a lawyer who actually understands the startup world that you and I live in? Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. I've known Scott Edward Walker for years, so tell him you're a friend of mine and he'll take good care of you. Here's the program. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. Over 700 interviews with proven entrepreneurs who've come here to tell you how they built their businesses so you can go out there, build your own company, and hopefully come back here once you do and do what today's guest is doing, which is tell your story and teach others. So what I want to find out in this interview is how can discovering a pain that most people, most business people even, don't notice that they have, how can doing that lead to building a successful new business? Patrick Collison is the co-founder of Stripe, which makes it easy to accept payments on the web. Stripe is used by thousands of online companies, including Shopify, Foursquare, New York MoMA, and Tarsnap. And Patrick, welcome to Mixergy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Paul Graham, guy who backed your company twice now, actually, right?
He was also an investor in our previous company.
So he said that one of the things that he admired about your business is that you noticed the problem that most people didn't even realize they had. How did you do it? How did you identify this big problem that the rest of us didn't notice at all?
So it's interesting. I guess most people never run into the problem of having to accept payments online, and that most people don't actually, or most internet users don't build a product or service that they need to charge for. As it happens, we were web developers. We built a lot of software, and this is in fact something that we'd encountered. And like a couple of times, I just built little side projects or something, and I thought it'd be kind of cool to charge for it, just to see, maybe there's like maybe unexpectedly you hit some like rich seam or something where it doesn't necessarily seem all that lucrative. That there might actually be something there, and we'd actually experienced this.
Can you give me an example?
With the App Store, we had run into this. A couple of years ago, I built an application for the iPhone that stored a copy of Wikipedia on the iPhone, so you could read it without needing internet access. And we launched this in the App Store, and we charged for it because you had to download a 2 GB dump from our servers, which cost us a fair bit in bandwidth. And so as a result of that, we had to charge a couple of dollars for the app, expecting it to, become. Maybe a couple of people would like it, but it was more just a fun side project. And then it ended up becoming really popular and got tons of downloads, and actually, it was a sort of a major income stream for a while. But there's just no way that I would have expected or predicted that. And it was like if it hadn't been so easy to integrate payments into the app or to have charged for it, there's just no way I'd ever have discovered that.
But you were able to integrate payments into the app through Apple's system, right?
Through Apple's infrastructure, they had made it incredibly easy to charge for the software we built.
Okay.
But online, every time that I built like a little tool or project or something like that, I'd either most of the time I actually hadn't integrated payments just because it seemed like so much work.
Can you give me a specific example? Tell me the story of a time when you were building a business and you
Yes.
were adding payments and you said, this is
Sure.
infuriating, there's got to be a better way.
Give you three examples. One is Optomatic. This was our last company, which was also funded by Y Combinator. It made it really easy for people to sell things on eBay. And there, we never integrated payments,
You
though
never integrated any payments into it.
simply because it was just too much hassle.
Do you remember when you tried integrating and what you experienced when you tried to add it on?
So I don't believe that we ever even like as in, we never went very far down the road of integrating payments just because we knew it would be so much hassle. And so it was always kind of on the roadmap for the future at some point. We never actually sort of went and had the conversations. The next project was a thing called Change Feed, which was, this was just like a tiny little tool that I wanted for myself. It was a thing where you give it a URL and it monitors the URL for changes and then gives you an RSS feed with a diff every time the link changes. And so it's cool for something like terms of service and things like that. Like,
it's a quick way to get an alert when a page online changes.
Yes.
I see.
And that is literally just something I wanted for myself, but it was as easy to make it available for others as it was sort of just myself. There I went about setting up payments for it and discovered that it was just a huge amount of hassle.
What kind of things? Because here's the thing that I know about you.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Graham thinks, apparently, you're so brilliant that he brought you to the Octomatic team, right? He said, this guy, Patrick, is brilliant. You guys should meet him and work with him.
Uh-huh.
Everywhere I look, when I look you up, I kept seeing people compliment how bright you are, how great a developer you are, how impressive the projects you worked on were, including Encyclopedia, which is what you talked about a moment ago. So you're
right.
A guy who could do any. You could even create a mobile a payment system. Why was payment so tough for you? What were you seeing?
So it was two things, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One is that, yes, ultimately people can, in fact, accept payments online. Like, this is a solvable problem and people do it. But just, it's so much hassle that it just ends up getting, pushed back. Or, like, there's always so many things competing for your attention. And there's prioritization, right? And so, with ChangeFeed, it wasn't like, oh, I'm not able to integrate payments, therefore, shit, I'm stuck, right?
Uh-huh.
It was more like, well, I could integrate payments, but it looks like that would probably take me a day. So, I don't know, maybe I'll just build a new feature, not bother charging, because chances are I won't make much money anyway. So, just, who cares? But also, it's just that it's so complicated. Like, there are merchant accounts and gateways and processors and ISOs and recurring billing providers and PCI and vaults and interchange and qualified and non-qualified and all these terms, and there's PDFs and tutorials that purport to teach you about all this stuff. And so it's from my standpoint, so before I knew anything this industry, for all I knew, what you actually needed to do was pretty simple, but just there was so much stuff there that I didn't even know if it was simple or not. And so, or where it's on that continuum it was. And so just, it ended up getting deferred. And so for
example, I see.
It was never the most pressing thing. And I never kind of ran that experiment of just charging a couple of dollars. And for all I know, maybe ChangeFeed would have become really popular, or, my mom would have paid for it and nobody else ever. And I just don't know. And it was, I never got to find out.
I see. You know what? You're right. You reminded me of all the steps that went into even us charging here at Mixergy. We had to get authorize.net,
uh-huh,
which is a gateway. We had to get PowerPay.
Yep.
We had to do something with American Express and Discover.
Yep. Just separately sign up for those.
And then we had to set up a shopping cart.
Yep.
And by the way, I didn't know until months later that we had authorize.net and Power. I didn't even know about PowerPay, even though I must
yep.
have signed something to get it on,
yep.
until I had an issue with someone who months later wanted a refund and I needed to figure out how to do it. And then they told me about PowerPay. I go, what?
Yes.
I didn't, it's all these steps. So you're right. So it's not just the development part. You could probably knock that out fairly quickly. You're saying it's all the different agreements you need and all the people you need to interact with.
Right. And even just figuring out which companies should be talking to. What even do I need? Is a merchant account enough? Or what's a gateway? Why aren't they the same thing? Why are these different roles? It's you need to go and assemble a server from scratch yourself, but you don't know what any of the components actually are. You don't even know what you need. And then coupled with that, sort of especially for, I guess, folks like us, for developers, people who are just kind of making things, if someone tasked you and said, you must get payments implemented, this week and you've a week to do it, yeah, sure, you'd figure it out. But if it's just a speculative thing or kind of experimental, whatever, it's often something you can defer and maybe you never get to it.
So when you're deferring it, how do you get to a place where you start to notice that this is something that you're deferring, and that you're deferring it not because you're afraid of charging, which some people are, not because you just want to keep the product pure, but because, hey, there's a hassle here that my mind just doesn't want to tackle and I wasn't aware of it? How do you become aware of it?
Yeah, so I guess for us it was this happening repeatedly. There was another, so I built an App Store analytics product, again just for my own use to track sales of this encyclopedia app. This was, so I actually wrote the app before the App Store existed, and then released it pretty early in kind of the history of the App Store. And so there weren't really many analytics tools out there. I mean, even just like even the most basic questions like, how much money did I make yesterday? There were no, like Apple's tools didn't even tell you that. And so I built this like really simple web-based tool. Again, I went to the payments for it. And I actually remember the day where I was chatting with John about it and just like so frustrated with it. And so I guess having the experience of seeing sort of how transformative it can be to sort of discover that something you built can actually become an income stream, and then kind of having the experience of repeatedly shirking this in other areas, the penny sort of started to drop and started to realize that, oh, hey, there's actually kind of something broken here. And then I guess in parallel with that, there was something kind of really interesting happening in the hosting industry where, 15 years ago or something, hosting meant, calling a sales rep at some hosting company and then getting, a physical server set up, mm-hmm. Contract. And, now there are, atoms tagged with your name and you need to understand the details of the specs, maybe upgrade the server, just all this stuff, right? And then EC2 and Linode and Slicehost and all these new companies come along where they give you sort of all the advantages of kind of shared hosting infrastructure where it's you can set it up instantaneously and you don't have to worry about sort of the physical computation details and there are no contracts and things are pretty standardized, but they also gave you sort of the complete control of traditionally renting your own box. And it just really struck us hey, why doesn't that exist in payments? Why can't I sort of have all the benefits of a merchant account and the ability to sort of define my own user experience and have credit card payments sort of really well implemented or integrated on my site, but sort of as easy to set up a server on Slicehost or EC2 or something. And I think kind of just that shift in the industry where hosting now just looks completely different, right? As in, for some people, it occasionally makes sense to go and actually rent a physical server, but for the vast majority of people, you should just spin up a VPS on one of these services. And it just seemed really clear that something like this should exist sort of for all of the major pieces of infrastructure that go into building a business on the internet. And so yeah, this repeated personal experience and that kind of shift in the hosting industry that we started to realize.
Okay. So one thing I've noticed on a personal level is that when people scratch their own itch as you have, they solve a problem that they have for themselves. Often they end up creating a solution that they're the only ones who understand because they didn't talk to anyone else. They didn't try to address anyone else's needs. They thought everyone else was exactly like them and could understand their solution exactly the way they did.
Yes.
How did you avoid that problem?
Good question. So that's a mistake that I made before and just, I built tons of...
When did you make a mistake of solving your own problem and having it be a solution that works so well just for you and not for anyone else?
I worked when I was pretty young on new programming languages. In particular, I worked on a language called Chroma, which was a new Lisp variant. And that, I realized, was very much tailored to the things I cared about and my own needs, not necessarily to those that everybody else cared about. Building a programming language is actually kind of an exercise in product design, and that never got much traction.
It didn't get much traction because you're building it just for you're building it based on your need?
Well, I thought I was building it for anybody's needs, but in reality, I was entirely building it for my own needs.
So what's one thing that you built that made sense for you, but if you took it out to the rest of the world, it just wouldn't make much sense to them?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Chroma did not make sense.
But you're saying the whole thing didn't make sense.
Yes. It just didn't solve problems that other people cared all that much about. I cared about the problems.
What's a problem you cared about that the rest of us didn't care about?
I wanted serializable delimited continuations in my programming language, and very few other people want this, it turns out.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? Before you even answer the next question, the previous question, which is how you made sure that Stripe didn't suffer the same fate, I got to take a pause here and do something that I should have done before, but I kind of assume everyone in my audience knows Stripe. In fact, they're the ones who are emailing me and telling me to have you on because they integrate Stripe into their businesses. But maybe we should just take a moment and tell people, what exactly is Stripe for someone who doesn't know it?
Sure. Stripe is the easiest way to start accepting payments on the internet.
How quickly can I accept payments?
You can start accepting payments instantaneously, or I guess you can accept payments as quickly as you can integrate Stripe. There's no sort of synchronous blockers on our end. And so go to Stripe, create an account, fill out basic details like your name and your bank account number and stuff like that. Integrate Stripe.js onto your web page or integrate into your mobile app or whatever, and you can just start charging credit cards. And there is no sort of phoning us up or like submitting fax paperwork or any of that. It's instant setup.
Just right. Conceivably, someone who's listening to us right now and is looking for something to do, maybe fidgeting at their keyboard, they could go to Stripe, sign up, get an account, and while they're listening,
this interview, they can be live and have things running on their website.
And accepting payments.
Yes.
Okay.
And crucially, there have been things before, like Google Checkout and PayPal and Amazon Payments and all this stuff. Some of those were kind of easy to set up on some level or something, but they really compromised the user experience in that your users were sort of whirled away into this like off-site vortex or something, and they like twist around in that for a while, and they get like dumped out back onto your site at some point, kind of dazed and confused.
You know what? So that's exactly what I did when I first started. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're absolutely right, and I've got to jump in here because when I needed to quickly accept payment, I went and I used PayPal. Quickly, you can set up and start collecting payments. But what I didn't notice was, until I logged in using somebody else's account, they were basically upselling my customers on their products at PayPal and causing confusion that would basically lead someone to go buy a PayPal product and maybe never buy mine.
Yes. The user experience of all these things really sucks. And so the thing we wanted to do with Stripe is sort of provide like a first-class user experience, i.e. like one that you completely define. You integrate the payment into your site in whatever way makes sense for you, but provide sort of the same kind of instant setup, like super easy benefits that they had. And then kind of following up from that, like, I guess the other problem with sort of the PayPal and the Amazon payments and the Google checkouts, whatever, is they sort of, like, one of the perceptions they're kind of for smaller operations, or like by having kind of, by using Google Checkout on your site, that's kind of a signal that you're not all that serious or big a business, because you rarely see those on large or some serious businesses. And also, they don't tend to scale very well. And by scale very well, what I mean is like they're really targeted at smaller users, and just like the really basic tangible stuff, like how you export your data, or how you search for a transaction, or how you do reconciliation, or how you like match up transfers to your bank account, or like all those things that you care about at sort of any appreciable scale, they don't do very well. And so what we wanted to do is have Stripe sort of work incredibly well sort of at that initial moment where you want to integrate payments into your Stripe, but then like on an ongoing basis, like say if your business takes off and you're doing like 100K a year, or maybe even a million a year, or like in the wildly successful case, like 100 million a year, we wanted to sort of Stripe to scale really well with kind of each of those points. Just like AWS or something, where like EC2 will work really well if it's just you and it's some like side project experiment, but it'll also work really well for Netflix. And we sort of wanted Stripe to like span the gamut there. So that's what you want to integrate payments. You're of any size. We want to make it incredibly easy to get started, and then really effective on an ongoing basis.
All right, so going back to the question that I had earlier, you have this problem. You are unique. How do you make sure that you don't solve the problem for people who are uniquely like you, which is nobody? What did you do to make sure that it applied to other people?
So I don't know there's only one good answer that I know of to that question, and that's get other people using it as quickly as you possibly can. And so John's my co-founder, and also brother, actually, started. We had this idea, and then just after Christmas one year, we had to go and take a month's holiday, and we went to Buenos Aires, and we just sort of started hacking on this. And I think we got there on January 1st. It was January 1st or 2nd, and we had our first live production user on Stripe on, I want to say January 11th, but I'm not completely sure of that date, but I think it was January 11th. So basically like 10 days after we started hacking, we had our first real user using Stripe and running payments through it.
How'd you get the first user?
He was a friend of ours. It was actually Ross Boucher from Twitty North, the guys who built the Cappuccino web framework. And then we added another user, and then a couple more after that. And so just like right from the start, we had these real people using it. And Paul Buchheit from Gmail tells this great story about how he sort of prototyped Gmail, where he built it on top of Google Groups, because that was already kind of an email product. And so he just kind of hooked the Google Groups UI up to his own email, and then he could browse and search his email or whatever. And then he started giving access to it to other people, and the other people are like, this seems really great, but like, how about instead of showing me your email, you show you my email? And it was kind of like that with Stripe, where like when we first released it to Ross, it was an incredibly sort of minimal product.
Let's talk about how long did it take before you got the first user again? What was the number of days?
I don't remember the precise dates, but let's say it was about 10 days.
Roughly 10 days. What did you build in those 10 days?
So what we built was an API that allowed you to charge credit cards and I believe we had a really minimal web interface that allowed you to view those charges, but we may not even have had that actually. It may literally have just been an API where you can submit a credit card number and amount, and we will charge it.
So I just send you a credit card number, an amount, name,
yes,
et cetera, and you say charged.
Yes.
That's it.
That's pretty much it. Like, you definitely couldn't refund transactions. We had to build that as you needed it. The web interface for sort of viewing transactions and searching and all that kind of stuff, that all came later. Even the infrastructure around transferring money to bank accounts, I think, came later. I'm pretty sure that wasn't there on day one.
So basically day one, the money was staying in your bank account.
Yeah.
Ross couldn't get the cash out for himself yet.
In a couple of days, but yeah, it was just like, what is the simplest possible thing that we could build that would enable Ross to start using this on his side? I mean, of course, we were helped by the fact that he was a good friend, right? And that this wouldn't have been acceptable to release this to, like, quote unquote, like a paying user.
Ross did this because he's a good friend.
Yes.
Why else would he do this? Why? You have tons of great friends and tons of people who would die to help you out because they know you're going places. They want to be helpful early on. Why Ross specifically?
I guess it was kind of a combination of things where we knew him. We knew that he needed to accept payments for this product they were building. We really respected his sort of design sense and technical sense. And we thought that sort of the feedback he was likely to give us would be really good. And that, I don't know how many of your viewers know of Cappuccino, the web framework, but Cappuccino is just like unbelievable. Like, I think people are now kind of talking about this new breed of modern web frameworks, like built in JavaScript and like CoffeeScript and Ember and Backbone and all this stuff. Cappuccino, I think, is still the most advanced web framework, certainly client-side web framework ever written. It was basically done by these three guys in a pretty short span of time. And so they're just like incredible software engineers. And so we're building a product where we're trying to sort of fix a deficiency on the web on some level. And this was also kind of their mindset, like, what are the primitives that we should use to build great products on the web? That confluence of things where they needed this product, they were friends, and they just like this really good design sense, they made for like a pretty, or Ross made for a pretty good first user.
Okay. Was he also looking at the world and saying, hey, I don't like whatever's out there and I don't want to spend time building it either?
Yes, very much so.
So he shared the same pain that you had, he had
yes,
to.
Yes, very much so.
Okay. So he's looking at, by the way, before I even ask you about his feedback, what about you? You don't feel awkward saying to this guy who you admire, whose feedback you want, hey, you know what? You're never going to get refunds. All right, you're not going to get refunds in version one. You're not going to get all this other stuff.
I mean, we're pretty upfront about that. But from his standpoint, I think you can look at it the other way, which is like, online payment sucks. There's all these dinosaurs that provide terrible service. Like, we will build the product that you want, and like, you can start using it right now. And as you give us feedback, we'll like immediately go and build the stuff that you'd like to see. And so I think actually from like the other person's perspective, that's actually a kind of compelling proposition. And like, if somebody else who like I actually thought execution was good came to me and said they would solve some like acute problem that I have, and like as soon as I give them feedback, they'll go and iterate on it. Like, basically my own sort of boutique
consulting company.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they get a free consultant.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. I think that's actually that would be awesome. And I love, like, I think there's a few things kind of more motivating for a user of software than to just like see it improve really quickly in kind of a direction you approve of, even though it's kind of not quite there yet. I know what you mean.
That is inspiring.
Perturbed.
What about before you launched? Did you talk to Paul Buchheit, the founder of Gmail? Did you talk to friends and say, hey, do you guys have this problem too? What are you doing?
Yes, I mean, we've talked to Paul a bunch of stuff in the past. He's actually also an investor again in our previous company. And I guess we talked to a lot of people just about this problem space generally and kind of heard about what their pain points were and what they used and what they kind of wished existed. And
What's one thing that you discovered in these conversations that you didn't know when you were just thinking about it on your own?
In the beginning, we were much more focused on kind of the ease of setup, because that was kind of the real issue that we kept hitting. But as we had more of these conversations, we realized that even for the people who kind of got set up and were actually accepting things online, that the experience still sucked for them. They got like statements in the mail, and like they couldn't possibly figure out like the most basic stuff. Like most of the people we talked to didn't know how much they were paying. Right? As in, they were getting some amount of money into their bank account every month. It was like roughly of the order of what they were charging. Like, were they paying 1%, 2%, 3%, 5%, 10%? They just didn't know. And often they'd tell us numbers and be like, oh, interesting, you know. And then at some point later, we'd like ask if we could see their statements because we really wanted to analyze kind of what they were being charged for and why and how. And we found that, like, in most cases, what they thought they were paying actually wasn't what they were paying. Like, intentional obfuscation. And so, yeah, like the ongoing stuff and the, and again, really prosaic issues. Like, there's one guy who now uses Stripe who is a pretty heavy user and previously used PayPal. And like, his issues with PayPal are stuff like it's really hard to find a transaction and just like refund it, right? As like, it was a basic thing. I log into PayPal and I have to like page through all these transactions, and every page load is really slow. Like, the whole process just like refunding a transaction takes me like 10 minutes. Whereas instead, I would like to just like type ahead search bar, press enter, and then like check refund. Just the really basic things, like all kind of stuff. So, anyway, from all these conversations, we started to think much more about sort of how we can make Stripe awesome for people who were already up and running and like had real businesses, and not just kind of trying to figure out how we could turn all those people who had been put off by even a notion of processing payments and how to turn those into people accepting payments.
So from what I'm understanding, there wasn't a formal list of questions or a formal process of asking people, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So what a lot of people, a lot of entrepreneurs who I interview who talk to customers and figure out what to build based on those conversations, what they often warn me against is you don't want to ask a question with the expectation that people are going to come back to you with a specific kind of answer. You don't want to say, "Hey, I'm thinking of building this. Is this the best?" and
Yes.
not give them room to say, "No, it's not." You want to So how did you do it? If you were just casual, how'd you make sure that you weren't influencing the answers that they were giving you?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that we did a fantastic job of not influencing their answers. We may actually have influenced them. And I think that on some level with Stripe, we're just kind of lucky, where like we just stumbled upon this like this geezer, as in, like there's just this giant problem here. Like the payments infrastructure of the internet sucks. And I guess I don't think that we necessarily did an especially good job of sort of being systematic about how to kind of discover the optimal product here. It was more just kind of our instincts where this should be built for like developers and makers and the end users as opposed to sort of the business people, and that it should be sort of instant setup and basically treated as a technology problem as opposed to a finance problem. But like, I can claim that we had a great like a very disciplined process for really proving that that was the case. It was more just our own suspicion. And that's what I mean, I guess, when I say that. I think on some level we're just lucky. But yeah, the one thing that I think was helpful was that we just had real production usage almost literally from day one.
Real production usage. So, and by the way, then this shows that even if you're not perfect, as long as you talk to customers, the influence that they have on your product is going to be positive. The
Yes.
way they open your eyes to issues that you didn't know because you didn't feel them, because you weren't depending on those payments to come through PowerPay or whoever else, right? That's
Yeah.
helpful.
For sure, for sure. And I think, I mean, there's lots of kind of schools of thought here, in that there's the classic Henry Ford TA about asking customers and you get a faster horse or whatever. And obviously, I guess it's going to a balance. But I think that, you know, once you've decided where the future sort of should be, as we decided, like, kind of if you look at the structure of the industry and, like, just even just thinking rationally about how the internet should work, like, this kind of service should exist. I think once you kind of meet that leap that customers might not necessarily tell you about, then for like, implementing that concept, you should talk to users like as much as you possibly can. And similarly for Henry Ford, you know, he might decide that, okay, the motor car, that's where it's going to be, right? But like once he's decided that, it would probably be great to his benefit to then go and like talk to customers for the car like constantly and figure out what the issues and bugs and pain points are, whatever. So I think there's probably some kind of balancing act, but yeah, I think that kind of once you have the leap and you've kind of hopped that chasm in your mind, then talking to users as much as possible is I think it can almost only be a good thing.
All right. And so you showed it to a first customer within about 10 days. Mm-hmm. What did the first customer say? What was the feedback that you got?
I have to dig up the emails here and the IM transcripts.
Does anything stand out?
My recollection is that he was just very kind of satisfied. It's like, oh yes, you know, this is how it should be. Great. And I mean, it's not like on some level, it's Stripe is just kind of amazing. Not so much because it's sort of this wholly implausible like technological leap. It's more like do you think this Stripe is amazing? It's amazing, relative to everything else. It's amazing that like you know everything else was so bad, like this you know finally exists. And I think with a lot of users, including Ross, was like, yes, good job. Like, this is indeed, in fact, what I've always wanted.
So you're showing it to customers, not necessarily just the first one, but you're showing it to a handful of customers early on because you want their feedback and you want their influence on your product.
Yes.
So let's step away then from the first customer and talk about those early experiences. What did showing your product to real people teach you that you wouldn't have known if you were just building it on your own with your brother?
I guess I've already kind of talked about the ongoing account usage question a little bit. There were a lot of just kind of use cases that we hadn't thought a lot about.
Can you give me an example? What's one thing that that hadn't occurred to you?
So, for example, recurring billing. Obviously, a ton of people do recurring billing. We're now on our sort of third kind of major version of our recurring billing infrastructure. Like, we sort of first talked to a bunch of people and sort of figured out a set of abstractions we thought would cover, you know, most use cases pretty cleanly. We then realized that we were actually missing a bunch. We rolled out another version, and now we're run third. And I think there's a good chance that there will be a fourth. And that I think can only really come from.
But the whole idea of recurring billing wouldn't have occurred to you as being so important.
We knew. Well, actually, yes. In the beginning, I'm pretty sure that I thought that we shouldn't even have recurring billing features. That was pretty easy for developers to build themselves, and they should just do that. And then, like enough people asked for it, like probably half our users asked for it, and we realized that we should probably just build it ourselves. And actually, there we've been kind of moving up the sort of through the levels of abstraction. And that our first recurring billing tool was basically just like a clock, and users had to do most of kind of the billing logic yourself. Whereas now in Stripe, we have sort of this first-class concept of plans and coupons and invoices and invoice items, and kind of we really have brought together all of the sort of atoms that people typically tend to want to sort of build subscription infrastructure around. And that was entirely driven by our users. And actually, the person who built that that recurring billing infrastructure, previous to working at Stripe, she built a company that did subscription payments on top of Stripe. She was very well positioned to build that.
So why couldn't people do recurring billing on their own? It does kind of seem to make sense that if you can program your side of the interaction as a merchant and send Stripe credit card number and username and so on for a customer, couldn't you just do that again a month later and then a month after that? What were you finding that made them say, hey, you guys should do this for us?
So this is, I think, quite so... this is kind of what we thought, right? It's just, you know, just charge an amount every month.
Right, right.
How hard can it be?
That's not the hard part. The hard part is actually just getting up and running quickly. The hard part is doing refunds and finding customers in an easy way.
This is all we thought. And then you realize that actually, well, maybe they don't want to charge every month. Maybe they want to charge, you know, every quarter or every year or every twice a month or something like that. And then maybe, do they want to charge sort of like after the service has been provided or before it's been provided? And then what happens if like one charge fails? You probably want to like kind of allow them to update their credit card and then charge them for like whatever stuff is pending. Like you have a couple of payments kind of stacked up.
Yep.
And then maybe you charge them some amount every month, but maybe the sort of additional things they can buy, so like it's the $20 base plan and $5 or $10 or whatever dollars of add-ons. And then maybe there's also some kind of usage-based portion. And then maybe you have coupons where like, it's a 10% discount for your first year if you have like such and such a code from such and such a podcast and you sign up or something. And just like it keeps going. Like what happens when you say you have that add-on and then you only have it for half the month and like I only want to charge you like a prorated amount. To just like this kind of fractal complexity where, yes, ostensibly sending an amount every month, most developers can do that. But once you really kind of dig into the real world scenarios and what people want to do, it turns out there's usually quite a bit of subtlety there. And it's kind of sufficiently universal and sort of common that we can actually do a pretty good job of it.
I see. It's that point when it's that complex, it does become a whole job for them, a whole other business, and they don't want to be in that business.
There are entire companies built around this. Like there's Chargeify, there's Recurly. These are companies that basically do sort of subscription billing infrastructure.
I see, because it is such a big pain. Anything else that stood out like that? You're talking about...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess this might not be too surprising, but one thing we just didn't think much about initially that we sort of discovered that people really cared about was having visibility into the transfers coming into their bank account from Stripe. And so this is actually a kind of interesting one because before Stripe, you had like merchant accounts, gateways, and sort of all these other companies, and they were all kind of loosely integrated together. Like you said, you'd authorize them, wasn't it the company?
PowerPay, authorize.net.
Okay, yeah, right.
American Express.
Yeah, and so you get statements from American Express and maybe like bank transfers from American Express, where I get bank transfers from like this merchant account provider or whatever, and then the gateway doesn't really know sort of what's going on like the bank side. It only knows what's going on like the API side, the charging side, and just like there's all these kind of separate silos. And Stripe, because we integrate everything, it's actually really easy for us to sort of know what's going on every side. And that means we can do things which, for example, Authorize.net just cannot do. Like, for example, tell you, have I got the money yet for this charge? When will I get the money for this charge? This is transferred into my bank account. Like, what was that for? Like, why did this happen? And it turns out that our users actually cared a lot about that. And actually, in particular, accountants just loved it. And that, like, all these companies, if they sort of start to become successful, they usually hire somebody at the end of the year to do their taxes or something. And this accountant or whoever is charged with doing the books is like going through the bank account statements, whatever, and trying to reconcile things. And for most systems, it's just like random amounts of money like appear, and they have to like do a best guess as to like why this happens and like what that corresponds to, and just kind of reconciling kind of the one side of the business with the other. And with Stripe, that was just really easy. So actually, we built this kind of transfers display just because it seemed easy. Like we just figured that maybe someone would be kind of curious about it. And then it turned out that that accountants like loved it, and so we ended up building this infrastructure to like export the data and like an API, so you could like really introspect it, and you could sort of check, or you could view sort of which charges went into a particular transfer, just like this really kind of granular detail.
And that goes into the bank statement.
So that's not on the bank statement, but basically for like a particular transaction in your bank statement, you can tell just like exactly why that happened.
I see, by going back to Stripe.com.
Yeah.
Yes, because you're right. Otherwise, you look at your bank statement or your accountant does, and he sees this big, lots of little payments, lots of little
Yes.
expenses and revenues, and then boom, this big number that you don't know what it
Yes.
is.
Yes.
And they
Yeah.
have to go and figure out, can I go to the shopping
And
cart for it or what?
pretty material, right? It was like $457.13 just appeared in your bank account. In which year did those sales occur? And like even those basic questions like that are typically ones that you cannot answer with most kind of merchant account infrastructure.
So here's the thing. I started out this interview thinking, how does a guy who scratches his own itch, first of all, how does a guy who scratches his own itch figure out how to build a product that satisfies other people? Well, your itch stopped at, I needed to get a merchant account and I just didn't want to deal with all the headaches involved in that. This would not have been a problem that you had yourself. So where did you even
That's
get the idea that to create a page that accountants might get excited about?
So this is interesting. This is kind of, I think, where the idea started to kind of lead us. And this is kind of what I mean about like us discovering a geezer or like an updraft or thermal or something. We're just kind of like pulled along by it. So yeah, we had this initial idea that just it should be way easier to start accepting payments online, and that all that infrastructure should look very different. As we started to sort of dig into it, we sort of uncovered all these other problems. And actually, like Stripe itself underwent a fairly big kind of shift in our own heads, in that in the beginning we really thought about it as this kind of this side project. Like we were building Slice Host, but for payments or something like that. This is for folks just like us. And then this was maybe 8 months later or so, like over kind of the subsequent summer, we realized that this is actually just like an enormous problem on the internet. Like it's not that we're building Slice Host for payments, but just like the fundamental like economic primitives of the internet are horribly broken. Like it is incredibly difficult in like every single case to transfer money from A to B. And I mean, if I'm building a product or service, say in the US, like even if I accept credit cards, like even if I get that piece up and running, a majority of internet users cannot transact with me because most people don't even have credit cards. Like if you're in Indonesia or Germany or Guatemala or whatever, chances are you probably can't purchase from my website. Like I'm not actually selling online, or if I am, I'm selling to like a small subset of internet users. And then if I'm in fact in one of those countries, like Indonesia or Guatemala or Germany or whatever, like it's even harder for me to start accepting payments online there than it is in the US. And you've sort of all these like disenfranchised users. And just like this whole kind of raft of problems that I think because it's been sort of so bad on the internet up to now, we've almost lost sight of like just how bad it is. Like it's kind of remarkable, I think, that we're in 2012 and it just you cannot accept payments from a majority of internet users, right? As in that service is not available to you. And so as kind of these realizations started to sort of percolate in our minds, we then started to sort of take Stripe more seriously. And that we started to sort of really kind of systematically talk to people, kind of hear what their pain points were.
How do you systematically do it? What's your process?
Systematically still just talk to lots of users, get more of them, like interact with them
How do you
constantly.
do it? And by the way, I'm not looking for the most professional setup that everyone else can follow and gets taught in Harvard business classes,
Yes.
but even if it's just a casual way, how do you do it in a consistent way?
Okay, so we like I think it's all just about maximizing the contact between the people who are building the product and choosing what it should be and the people actually using it.
Okay.
And so for the first, certainly for the first year, like we were the only people doing support. Like you had a problem with Stripe, you just like emailed us and we fixed the problem. And like that's all there was. And so that was like a great incentive for us to like fix the actual issues that people run into. And like to this day, both John and I do support.
Okay.
Like we deal with the questions. And like but that's not just John and I, like most people at the company do support. And like the people building the product just like hear directly from the users constantly. And I think that's almost the long and short of it. And we'd often like have users like come over to our office or we'd go visit them or like we'd reach out to them
You
or
visit people's offices?
oh sure, we visited like tons of our users.
What do you see when you look at someone's office?
I mean, with regard to Stripe, it is in
Yeah,
general.
with regard to Stripe, do you remember walking into someone's office and looking at their computer and seeing something that you wouldn't have thought of, or learning something as a result of that that you couldn't have done remotely?
I'm trying to think, so my answer I feel like is yes. I'm trying to think of a specific example.
I'm kind of putting you on the spot constantly saying, do you have a specific here? Do you have a specific there?
But I know it's a good way to do it. Yes. So
Perfect.
there was a company selling robots on top of Stripe, and they were one of our favorite users because I mean they were selling robots. It was pretty awesome. And I remember visiting their office, and they didn't sell a ton of robots, and the robots were pretty expensive, and so they actually hadn't automated the procedure for charging for a robot. And
Okay.
so what happened is when they got a sale of a robot and someone was like checking their credit card or whatever, they would like review the order and I don't know, I guess like I don't know, order some robots to build more robots or something. And then the guy would like literally start typing a curl command like against the API to like charge the credit card. On some level, it was kind of cool that the API was simple enough that you could just like do that every time. But on another level, it kind of suggested that we should possibly have a method within Stripe for just performing like an ad hoc charge. And so now, if you log into your Stripe account and you're looking at your payments, you see the button for like new payment, and you can like type in a credit card number and an amount and whatever, and charge the card. And I remember I was visiting his office. That was the first time that I realized that, okay, that might be a use case.
What a great story. So, when you walk in, you're just looking and saying, hey, how do you interact with Stripe? Can I watch what you do? Can
Oh,
I?
yeah, I find that stuff super interesting.
That's it. You just say, hey, can I just see how you use our system? Log
Yes.
in. Do you have them do specific tasks? Or you just say, do whatever you do, and I'll watch.
So yes, by and large, yes. And we've done a little less of this than I would like, but yes. And actually, one thing, we held an event at our office, I guess around 2 months ago or so. We just invited, it was Stripe office hours. Where you could come by the office, and if you had a problem with Stripe or questions, or you just wanted to integrate Stripe, or like thought you may want to integrate Stripe or something, you could come by and we just hang out and help out and watch and just like interact directly. And yeah, that was really useful.
So, Patrick, that brings up another question then. When you invite people into your office or you go to their office and you get a suggestion as a result of that, it's
Yes.
really hard not to do it. On the other hand, if you do everything that people suggest, Stripe is not going to be such a simple way for people to collect payments because it'll be overloaded with features. You're smiling. So, how do you do it? How do you decide what to do and what not to?
It's hard. Again, I don't have a great, profound answer. I guess so. It's a combination of things. We remove features. Like Stripe has had features in the past that just no longer exist because an insufficiently large number of users cared
Okay.
about it. We sort of iterate on features a lot. So a feature that Stripe has is, you've probably seen it, stripe.js, where you can sort of drop a single kind of JavaScript include into your page. And that basically what that does is it helps you sort of submit a credit card number directly to Stripe. We tokenize it and sort of remove the sensitive parts and give you back just the token that's then kind of not sensitive and not subject to PCI, and you can kind of pass that around to your web server or whatever, and you no longer need to worry about, like, oh, will there be credit card numbers in my log?
Okay.
And that feature, that Stripe.js, which is really cool and helps get companies like outside of the scope of PCI, that is on probably its fourth or fifth major iteration, and it's gone through like a bunch of just different implementations and like what exactly it did and how exactly it worked. And in ways that have been sort of challenging for us, where like we have to support all the old users, and we have to like make sure we don't break anything for their charges. But just yeah, like constantly trying to figure out like sort of where the natural boundaries are in terms of in the functionality.
Emmett Scherer from Twitch TV said that what he does is he has people rank the frustrations that they have. So you might say, give it to me in 1 to 10, and that way he knows. Yes. All right, the items they've identified as number one are really important to them. That's what we should work on first. Do you do anything like that? Maybe even internally?
So we do some of that internally. Like, we'll often go through a bunch of our user communication and our support email and chat. One thing that Stripe does, I think, this is something I always want when I deal with companies, is you can like just jump into a chat room immediately and start chatting with the developers, because that's usually by far the...
Someone sends you an email and you respond, but you also say, hey, let's get into this chat room here and start talking.
Well, then, like, you don't even need to email us. You can just go to like stripe.com/chat and just like start chatting. And that ends up being a pretty productive dynamic, because especially like one question often needs clarification and leads to another. Anyway, we often distill that, both the chat transcripts and the emails, and rank sort of people's pain points and issues and problems, whatever, which is kind of similar to MSThink. I guess we do that sort of more latently, as in we don't ask the users to rank them, we just kind of rank them based on what the kind of set of overall users has brought up. But it's also, I guess, just a lot of taste, as in it's, where do we think Stripe should go? Or like, I guess, a more kind of Henry Fordian. Based on all the feedback we've gotten, maybe we should, like, maybe nobody has asked us for this specifically, but if we actually did this, this would really solve like a whole host of use cases.
I see.
And I guess actually we tend to be pretty, it's always a balancing act. Like, you always want to be kind of sanding off like the rough corners in the product. But I think you also, you obviously can't let the immediate feedback drive it too much. And so I think we err pretty far on the side of trying to figure out, like, what do these people actually want? Because, I mean, for the people using Stripe and the people selling things, like, they're not experts in payments, and like, they shouldn't have to be. That's the whole point. They don't need to learn everything about this infrastructure, like this ecosystem. And so, like, when they come to us with a problem, you know, they might know what's possible. Like, for example, maybe they complain that PCI forms are confusing. And in fact, a feature request we often got is like, you guys should have some automated tool for, like, you know, filling out PCI forms. But, like, an actual fact, what would be way better is if we just made PCI go away. So that's not even a thing that you have to think about. So there's a fair amount of that. I think
what is
that
a PCI form?
I'm glad that you don't know, or it's nice that you don't have to. So PCI is sort of the industry standards around the protection of credit card information, and there are various self-assessment questionnaires that businesses are required to fill out depending on what they're doing. And Stripe.js enables a ton of these businesses to get outside of the scope of PCI altogether, and so they don't even need to put this.
I see. So they would have asked you to make it simpler or to help them autofill it out, and you say, no, maybe what we should do is just get rid of it if it's that frustrating.
Yes, exactly.
Were you able to get rid of it for them pretty early on?
You know, no, was the short answer. Like, PCI, it's really complicated, and it's sort of...
because they're also storing numbers themselves, right?
If they're... What they do is they store the card on Stripe, and then we give them sort of a reference to that card. So they're not actually ever storing the number themselves. It's like the number never touches their servers. The PCI sort of is pretty complicated and subtle, and it's really kind of an ongoing dialogue where, you know, PCI, or, you know, we talk a lot to the folks making the standards, the card companies, the banks, the auditors who, like, actually do the PCI audits. We are sort of PCI certified ourselves, and so it's just like this ongoing conversation. But that was something that came much later in the history of the company.
All right. Let me say this, and then I've got to come back and ask you two follow-up questions based on, well, actually two important questions. First, I'll say this. If you're a Mixergy Premium member, well, actually, do you know this, that what KISS Metrics does, and I guess a lot of people who follow Eric Ries's Lean Startup Philosophy, they actually go through a specific process of talking to customers. They have specific questions that they go through, specific way of handling it. Well, we got someone who works for KISS Metrics, Jason Avinash, to come to Mixergy and teach the process that they use at KISS Metrics, complete with the questions, how they get people to answer them, and so on. We're editing it. Apparently, the editor's working on it today. And if you're a Mixergy Premium member, by the time you see this, it should be on MixergyPremium.com, where you'll see a formal process to do this. And if you're not...
Stripe.
sign up. So I'd love to use Stripe because look at this, by the way. This is bullshit. Yes. I shouldn't be cursing my own interviews, but.
No, but
this is bullshit that I get this. It's bullshit that I get all these different things that you're talking about that I don't want the paper. I don't want to deal with it.
Yes.
I just don't know how to integrate it with my membership plugin. If I could, I would pay someone to integrate it with my membership plugin properly.
Okay.
To integrate Stripe. I would much rather have Stripe than the fucking bullshit that I deal with now. I never talk badly, and I'm not going to mention the PowerPay is a – I don't think it's a problem to talk badly about the process that involves PowerPay. But I wouldn't talk badly about the system that I use.
It's not even just PowerPay's fault. And PowerPay is just like along with all these other –
That's what I'm saying. No. There are people who are at fault in my system.
They're just like instances of a legacy archaic infrastructure, and that's like it's hard to do much better when you're stuck in that world.
And I did need something really quick and dirty to get up and running, and the process works. It's just not the ideal system, and I see people who use Stripe, and I would pay someone to integrate Stripe properly. And with my plugin is Wishlist. That's what we use to manage members. If I can get somebody to plug in a better system with them, I'd love it. I mean, Stripe and a better system that does it. And I would pay them. This doesn't have to be, hey, I want to do a favor for Mixergy so that I can raise my profile. I got to pay you. All right. So now that I've said that, I got to ask you two things based on my research on you that have nothing to do with what we talked about so far. One doesn't. The first is, you sold your previous company for, it's public, right? $5 million to Live That's right. Current Media?
That's right.
I heard that some people thought you sold too soon. What do you say about that?
They might be right. It's hard to know. For us, you know, Optomatic, we're very interested in this whole area of providing liquidity for used items. Like, I think a lot of the most exciting startups on the internet are about sort of introducing or facilitating sort of a new kind of coordination that wasn't previously possible. And so if you look at, you know, Kickstarter, Uber, and Etsy are sort of perfect recent examples of that, where, you know, they're fundamentally about coordination. And just like there are all these people in the world doing all these kind of disparate things, and these services kind of bring them together. And I think in the case of used goods, like it's really just inefficient that there's so much stuff in the world that, like, there's totally somebody who could make use of this and for whom it would be of great value, which is like, you know, for my old iPhone, like there are like tens, hundreds, billions of people who would love to have my old iPhone and who would even give me something for it. But like, how do I possibly find out who that is? And so we're really into that problem. That's kind
because of it's such a hassle to list it on eBay and to go back and forth with people who are going to be unhappy or have a question and so on, right?
Right. And so we're really interested in that kind of whole problem space generally. And Automatic was sort of our first step in sort of, I don't know, working with it, where just we were taking sort of all the people who are already selling at eBay and just like making the process of selling more effective. Mm-hmm. And so then we plan to think about ways in which we could sort of make buying easier or build a better marketplace or whatever else. And as it happens, it was just kind of a pretty kind of interesting time for that whole ecosystem as a whole, where eBay was kind of starting to decline a little bit. Google was really starting to think about it. Facebook had just launched Facebook Marketplace, and just kind of marketplaces and eBay style marketplaces were kind of a pretty hot area. And I guess from our standpoint, it was a combination. We were pretty excited by what LiveCurrent was doing, and sort of the in the conversations we had, it was pretty clear that they wanted to do something very similar to what we had in mind. And I mean, frankly, we were pretty young. We didn't have a ton of experience. Automatic was pretty new. And there's a real kind of non-linearity to the value of money. The notion of just having sort of that small bit of liquidity under our belt was pretty compelling, and I think for all of us subsequently, it's enabled us to sort of be freer to in terms of what we could explore and do and what we could think about doing. And like, honestly, even for these side projects, like for Encyclopedia and for even Stripe, like, you know, the fact that we're able to just go and take that month and hack in Buenos Aires, like, that was in part facilitated by buy that sale, you know, where we were just kind of, we were freer. And
you
so
didn't have to worry about money, so you can think about what you wanted.
Yeah, it's not that, you know, we were set for life or anything, but just like we were somewhat freer. And I mean, I was deemed an automatic was acquired, and just like having that sort of little bit of incremental freedom was really valuable. And so I think that like I have tremendous respect, obviously, for sort of the entrepreneurs that that don't sell. And I mean, with Stripe, we obviously haven't so far, and emphatically our intent is not to. But I think that it's...
It gave you the freedom, is the answer.
I think that, like, I guess really what I'm saying is it's a pretty sort of personal choice and kind of situation and circumstance and company dependent and all of those things.
What about Buenos Aires? I spent a year in Buenos Aires and I felt that working on Mixergy there made my interviews better, made my comfort in front of the camera better. It was just like what Bob Hyland,
Sorry? I had no idea that you'd spent time there.
Yeah, 2010, pretty much.
It's such a fantastic city.
Yeah. Oh, it was fantastic. For me, it was complete focus on my work. It was like my Shaolin, Bob called it, where I just got to focus and train every day. And then, of course, because people have dinner at 10 o'clock at night, I could still go out at night and have dinner and have friends and conversations and be back the next day.
It's so funny to hear you describe this because I've been seeing like exactly the same stuff. It's like the city on the hacker schedule. Like, it starts late. You can have dinner at like midnight, no problem. And like you roll into bed at 3 a.m. or something like that. There's Wi-Fi everywhere. It's really like, you know, because people are speaking a different language, and I guess I personally don't speak Spanish, and so like I don't overhear all these conversations around me. You
get sucked into meaningless conversations about things.
Yeah, right. It's really cheap, which I guess is sort of nice. You just want to spend a ton of time there focusing on one thing. The food is great. The weather is great. There's Wi-Fi at all the cafes. I guess I'm preaching to the converted here.
But I think it's important to say that it was huge for me. It was huge for you. It's.
I have incredibly fond memories of Buenos Aires.
City to live in.
I haven't been back since, but I've been like trying to find an excuse ever since, and I definitely will before too long.
All right, final question is, what advice do you have? I'm looking, by the way, at Paul Graham's blog post about you. How fantastic was it that he singled you out and your company out as like a model of the kind of companies he admires? And he goes, for over a decade, every hacker who'd ever had to process payments online knew how painful the experience was, he says. Thousands of people must have known about this problem, and yet, when they started startups, they decided to build recipe sites or aggregators for local events. Why work on problems so few people care much about and no one will pay for, et cetera? So for someone who says, I want to notice this problem that others are ignoring, do you have a piece of advice that will help them do that?
Yes. I'm not sure how you notice them, but the advice I have about some how you think about them, but I think that like in some, like almost definitionally, the harder problems are kind of like mechanically harder, in that like, there's more that you have to do and like think about and solve, and maybe the solutions are less clear or whatever. But I think they're actually easier in a really significant way, and that's they're easier to motivate yourself to work on and motivate others to work on, and like to sort of get a bunch of people together to like really solve something. And so I mean, I hate to sort of pick a specific vertical, because in almost like any area there are actually some good companies that are doing like really good work. But like, let's just take recipe apps, since that's the example he uses, but I have nothing against recipe apps. Like maybe with some recipe app, you want to assemble a bunch of amazing people to like really go nail some problem. And maybe if it's a recipe app, like it's harder to do that. Like I'm like, you know, Andrew, you know, this whole interview stuff, you know, this is all awesome. Like, why don't we go and solve recipes, right? Just that can be harder. And I mean, not just harder to motivate others, but like just for yourself. When you wake up in the morning, you're like, shit, I'm really going to like solve recipes today, right? Whereas if you're take the other extreme, where you're Elon Musk and you're like, you know, you wake up in the morning like, right, you know, what's the next step in putting man on Mars? And I think that in that kind of, I don't know, philosophical, existential way or something, the hard problems are actually kind of easier. Like that's just like a huge win. It just makes life so much easier for you in so many ways. Like when people like really get excited about the problem you're solving. And so for us, the fact that like we're trying to fix this like economic infrastructure for the internet as a whole, like that gets people motivated and excited. And so Yeah, that's the one piece of advice I have.
That's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for doing this. And of course, guys, the site is stripe.com. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Yeah.